from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at a local woman's weekly therapy session. The woman receives regular care for a mental health condition, and with the pandemic, she said she was concerned that she wouldn't be able to see her counselor. But within days of the state shutdown, her therapist let her know that she'd be able to keep that appointment. Instead of talking in her therapist's office, the young woman would join her virtually from home. And this woman's experience is shared by thousands of people in our area whose mental health appointments have moved online. They include people who were accessing care consistently before the coronavirus and new patients who have needed support as a result of the pandemic. Now, let's talk a little bit about telehealth in general. At the University of Rochester Medical Center, March 1st, pre-pandemic, across all departments and disciplines, they were doing about 100 telehealth appointments a day. Now, 6,000. That's all disciplines, not just mental health, but that's a massive change. The math says 60 times the amount of telehealth visits now. And the number of actual in-person visits is way down overall because they've tried to get the whole facility, the whole center, ready to deal with COVID. Well, the young woman who shared her story with us says she appreciated the virtual option and that joining from her own home actually made her feel more relaxed, more comfortable, even helped reduce some of the stigma, she says, that can come with mental health care. Stigma that's unwarranted, of course. And while the pandemic has led to these shifts in virtual care, both patients and providers are discussing if telepsychiatry appointments will become the norm. And what about teleappointments, telemedicine in general? We are seeing some temporary shifts. How much of this will be permanent? I admit, in the conversation I had yesterday with Dr. Michael Hasselberg, I was fascinated in thinking about this because what we're starting to see is a change in how medicine is getting done. That's not to say everything can get done in terms of telemedicine, but some of it's more efficient. Some of it actually makes people feel more comfortable. Some of it's cheaper. And some of it we might decide we want to keep. Even post-pandemic, Dr. Hasselberg is Chief of Technology and Innovation at the URMC Department of Psychiatry. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Evan. I'm quite excited.
A lot to talk about this hour. Hello as well to Vicki Spurr, who is a family program volunteer coordinator for NAMI Rochester, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Vicki, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, and I'm excited to talk further about this, and thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. And Laura Jowley is an outpatient behavioral health manager at Clifton Springs Hospital and Clinic. Laura, welcome. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me on your show.
So, Dr. Hasselberg, let's make sure that we've just got the outline correct here. So, March 1st, essentially pre-pandemic, you were seeing across the medical center, all disciplines, all departments, 16,000 to 17,000 people in person per day. Patient visits for everything from surgeries to consultations, screenings, et cetera. Now that number is, what, about 4,000?
That's correct, yeah. We've had a rapid pivot in regards to how we provide care at the medical center. And it's, you know, this is happening across the country. March 1st, we had about 16,000 patients that saw us on March 1st in person across our service lines. And March 15th, there was an announcement made internally that we were going to postpone all elective cases and non-essential in-person appointments. And we had a massive pivot very quickly, and now we're doing, as of the last data I have, April 20th, we did about 4,000 in-person visits and a little over 6,000 telehealth visits.
Wow, so more telehealth now than in-person visits, and pre-pandemic it was, again, maybe 160 to 1, so it's a huge shift, but let's also make another thing clear here, Dr. Hasselberg. I mean, we're going to see that start to shift back a little bit soon. Last night, we had a special WXXI forum in which Dr. Michael Mendoza, public health commissioner, said we can't postpone elective surgery and elective procedures forever. And he doesn't really like that term. I mean, I understand it's the term, but he says these are procedures or surgeries that need to get done eventually. We can't put them on hold forever. And it's probably going to be sooner than later that we start to shift it back here. So there will probably be maybe a little bit of a rebalancing, but certainly not back to what we saw on March 1st anytime soon. Is that fair?
That's definitely fair to say, and I think it's going to look different. So, yeah, you know, we're going to start doing elective surgeries again, but your pre- and post-op appointments may not be in person. You may be having those pre- and post-op appointments virtually in your home. So it's definitely fair to say we're going to start to see a shift and increase more in in-person visits, but I think some of the telehealth stuff that we're seeing is not going away anytime soon.
Now, when it comes to a visit pre or post-op, a lot of people are thinking, you can't do that in a televisit. I mean, if someone needs to have surgery, if someone needs to have some kind of a procedure physically, they may assume, no, I've got to be there in person. I mean, there's a lot of reasons for that. Would you explain on the phone to me yesterday? I'd love for you to take the audience through how you sort of break down the percentages of what's really required and what's going on there. You know, the 80 and 10 and 10 idea.
Sure. Yeah. So we estimate that the requirements to make a diagnosis and come up with a treatment plan, about 80% of the data we need is collected just by understanding the patient's social history and medical history. Only about 10% is laboratory tests and results, and about 10% actually a physical exam. And when we do telehealth and we're seeing folks in their own home environments, the data that we're collecting in that 80% of really understanding someone's social history, medical history, the social determinants of health that may be impacting them, we can actually see that when we're meeting the patient in their own home environment. So it actually, I think, improves the data we're collecting.
All right. So listeners are already starting to share their stories in general about what your medical experiences have been like during this pandemic. And if you want to do that, you can call 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255. You can email the program connections@wxxi.org. And we're certainly going to be focusing a good amount of this conversation on mental health because Dr. Hasselberg, as you explained, most departments are seeing lower numbers in terms of overall appointments and procedures for obvious reasons. This is by design to make sure there's a lot of space to deal with COVID, to deal with the pandemic in case there were surges, etc. But when it comes to psychiatry and those kind of visits, you're seeing, and I think as you explained to me, not only more cases, but more people keeping their appointments, not canceling.
Correct. I'm very proud of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester. We quickly pivoted within a week to 90% of what we're doing out of the department is telehealth at this point. We had previous experience in telepsychiatry and in small subgroups like to nursing home populations and rural hospital emergency departments, but now all of our service lines, with maybe the exception of our inpatient psychiatric units, are doing the majority virtual consults. And as our colleagues in other medical departments across the medical center had a decrease in volume of 30 up to 75%, depending on the department, we didn't really see a drop in volume. And we've actually, in select service lines, have seen a rapid increase in volume. And as you said, Evan, our no-show rates have gone remarkably down, and our cancellation rates have gone down, and our clinicians are reporting they're more efficient with the virtual mechanism. So I think psychiatry and behavioral health is a great example of where I think this will be our new norm potentially going forward.
Laura Jolly at Clifton Springs Hospital and Clinic, what are you seeing?
We're seeing similar to what was already reported. We are definitely immediately, the leadership team really pulled together to figure out how we were going to make this work in our space under the guidance of OMH and OASIS and taking direction from them with their new guidelines that came out because we had to immediately reduce the foot traffic coming through the door. So the telehealth, the televideo, all of those entities really took quickly to, the clinics here. The therapists really worked hard to get all the televideo and telehealth equipment up and running, Skype, Doxy.me, FaceTime, Doximity, just finding every way possible that we could reach our patients in their home. So I'm really proud of the team, really proud of all behavioral health in Rochester Regional because they all really pulled together to figure out how we can continue to take care of the patients that retreat day in and day out.
Laura, what have you seen in terms of keeping appointments versus cancellations or no-shows?
We've seen definitely a decrease in our no-show rate, both with phone calls as well as televideo appointments. We've certainly seen a large decrease in those no-shows.
Does that surprise you at all?
No, I think that patients, as was already mentioned, are very comfortable in their homes. And, you know, if they're already prepared for an appointment and they know to expect it, that they'll just answer their phone versus having to find transportation. You know, we're certainly reducing a lot of those barriers that make it difficult for people to walk into a clinic.
Hmm. Vicki Spur with NAMI Rochester, how do you view the challenge now of this pandemic, of making sure people are still connected to care, or do you also perhaps see it as an opportunity? How do you view it?
I think we see it as an opportunity. You know, I just want to reiterate too, NAMI Rochester was very quickly able to pivot and offer. So I just want to give a little brief. We do provide support, and we provide family support. We provide support for peers through a connections group. We also provide support to college students who right now, and that's something new. So when we're talking about an opportunity, that's something that came out of the college students who maybe did have a pre-existing or they're not living, but they are living with a new reality and need some help navigating that. So I think for some family members, we've been able to offer our Family Fridays for the last 5 weeks. And so it's been helpful because we have some family members outside of the Rochester region that were looking for opportunities. So we've brought along some new family members who are looking for support to help their loved ones during this crisis.
I want to talk a little bit more about college students. You know, what a this is a shock for everybody. I mean, there's no age group that isn't shocked by living through a pandemic. Nobody really had a playbook for this. But, you know, imagine you are a few months away from what should have been, or maybe now weeks away from what should have been a college graduation, moving into the working world, maybe a summer internship, maybe a study abroad, maybe just regular, you know, sort of college life and interaction. And all of a sudden, all of that is on hold. There's a lot of uncertainty about what you can get back out of that or how to kind of re-engage with that. And you're in close quarters now, most but not all, with family, with parents, and college students sort of famously think, well, I never have to live with you full time again. There's all kinds of different challenges here that are legit, but what concerns you the most?
Well, I think, you know, what you were saying as far as their reality has become a different reality. You know, I have a niece who was living here in Rochester. She going to college, living with, you know, three roommates, having a wonderful time. And then all of a sudden, well, wait, I've got to go back to, you know, where I'm from and I have to change. She had a job here in Rochester. So, you know, their structure, their predictability, their routine, and just staying connected. So I think for those college students, how do I stay connected? How can I look forward to knowing when there might be a norm and what do I have control over and what can I, how can I work through this and how can I find support and being able to say, I'm having trouble right now. I'm struggling a little bit. I need some help. And so that was one of the ways we were able to provide that through, it's led by a licensed social worker. And it's just meant to be that opportunity to connect with each other. Because if you think about it, they've been living with each other for this length of time, you know, 4 years, and all of a sudden you're kind of torn apart and separated. And how can we help them find ways to still stay connected? So I know for my niece in particular, you know, they're utilizing FaceTime and Zoom and making opportunities to set up appointments to have some predictability and structure back in their life during this time.
Vicki, I wonder if you have any thoughts about how that generation, which is, I guess, college students now technically Gen Z, do you think that collectively they may view therapy, mental health sessions, appointments differently than maybe our generations have? And the reason I ask is because, you know, I know I'm making generalizations and there's a lot of different views on this, but so often, for years, if someone in your circle of friends would have, you know, would tell you, oh, you know, so my husband and I went to therapy, or, you know, my son and I went to therapy, your first thought would be like, oh, like, wow, like, what's wrong? Like, is something wrong? You're in crisis? As opposed to thinking, oh, good, yeah, that's good for everybody. You know, like, we all need that, no matter what has happened in our lives. And I'm wondering if you think that this Gen Z generation current college students view it differently, view it more openly to saying, hey, you know, that's a smart thing to do. That's part of life, that there shouldn't be a stigma attached there.
In my experience in having conversations with younger adults, and I'm a parent of a young adult who does live with a mental health condition, there is more of an openness. And I can also just share, I worked for the School Mental Health Resource and Training Center. So I went into schools and had some conversations with students, and they're very open, and they view that their mental health is just as important as their physical health. So I think that we're fortunate that there's that openness, and that we started pushing into, and NAMI does a lot with ending the silence in school districts, and, you know, being able to hear other peers who have had experiences and been able to go to the other side, that lends itself to having conversations about, I struggled, but I found support, and I'm going to be okay. And I think in listening to some other young adults, they're very comfortable and talking about, this is what I'm feeling, and being able to share it, because that judgment and the stigma that we've been fighting for so long to remove is removing itself. There's a level of acceptance and just meeting people where they're at. And I think that makes me more hopeful for this, you know, particular generation of students compared to when I was in school, and we certainly, you know, would be very reluctant to talk about it.
Yeah. Laura Jolly, how do you think society is doing at removing those kind of stigmas?
I think that there's been a lot of improvements. There's several school districts that I know that implement mindfulness skills down to elementary level, which mm-hmm. I think is starting to help kids understand, you know, mental health holistically and the importance of taking care of their mental health from a very young age, and providing those coping skills so that they have them as they mature through adolescence and high school and adulthood. Because I think, you know, being in this field for 15 years, that's the thing I hear day in and day out, that, you know, these patients, a lot of them never learned healthy coping skills. So teaching mm-hmm. young children how to cope with life events, I think, is certainly helping to reduce the stigma and helping them to understand and giving them tools to be able to talk about what might be going on.
Yeah. Dr. Hasselberg, I had an appointment about 10 days ago with, I was going to say my therapist. She's one of my therapists. I've got therapists for different toolkits, you know, and she's phenomenal. And we had a great appointment. And before the appointment, she asked if I wanted to do it sort of, I guess, via Zoom or via tele. And we ended up just settling on a phone call for about an hour, and it was great. Are patients generally given any options on that? I mean, is it mostly video visits? What's it look like?
We're still offering face-to-face appointments. We're also offering telephone and video consultations. What we're seeing is majority of our patients are electing to choose the telephone or video consultations, and I actually think, you know, we're encouraging folks to try the video if they have not done it before. But we do offer all the options.
Yeah, I mean, the issue I have is I never get out of sweatpants at home. So, I mean, like, that's another change, by the way, that isn't coming back. Listen up. No one's going back to real pants after this pandemic world. I just want everyone to know, elastic waistbands forever. Listeners, if you want to share your thoughts on telemedicine, really telemedicine across disciplines, we've got to focus on mental health this hour, but we're also having the larger conversation about how we are making these adjustments for all medical needs right now. And how has your experience been with that? 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And I'm going to read Andrew's email first. He says, Evan, it seems that there would be a large cost savings to the medical office for telemedicine versus traditional office visits. Will this cost savings be passed on to the consumers who opt for the telemedicine appointments and or their insurance providers? I hope so, as the rising cost of health care can contribute to increased insurance premiums, etc. And also, would the use of telemedicine make referrals from the primary health providers no longer necessary? It seems to me that going to the primary health provider and paying for that visit and then going to a specialist is financially overdoing it. What does your panel think? Well, Dr. Hasselberg, we talked about this on the phone. This is a big opening to kind of talk about where we are with this and where we might go. So I'll let you start. Go ahead.
Sure, yeah. I think what we're starting to see here is a fundamental transformation of the healthcare system. I would call this healthcare's digital revolution. Pre-pandemic, you know, our healthcare system was set up in terms of our clinical workflows and reimbursement incentives around bringing patients to us. So we get paid for the number of patients we have in our emergency departments, the capacity level that our hospital's at, how many procedures we can do in the office. That is how we get paid, and that is how we are set up. What I think that you're starting to see with this digital shift is, you know, we can actually, like the listener said, save a lot of money if we keep folks out of the hospital. You know, we provide their care in their homes, in their own communities. It's, you know, more convenient for the patient. So now the provider's going to the patient. It's increasing access. What we're finding in our research is the quality of care is, in a lot of cases, just as good, and even in some subcases, possibly better than face-to-face, and as the listener said, at a much reduced cost. I think in order to get there, however, and I think that this pandemic is allowing us to show this, how this transformation to digital care can be beneficial, is we're going to need policy changes. We're going to need the federal government and Congress to weigh in on this, to shift how healthcare is reimbursed. We've seen it during this outbreak. Congress has lifted a lot of provisions in regards to some of the over-regulations around digital health and telemedicine. They've lifted a lot of provisions in regards to co-payments and how this is reimbursed. Within the state Medicaid plans have also laxed their regulations and restrictions. And I think what we're going to see coming out of this is, yes, this is a more cost-effective, high-quality, convenient way of providing health care.
I want to ask this in a way that sort of doesn't imply that the medical system is only after money, but you're being very honest about where and how money is made right now. So is there an incentive for the medical system to not want this to become a permanent change?
I'm not sure. I think, you know, that's a tough question to ask. I think the health system, made up of clinicians and providers, you know, we all went in this because we wanted to help people and we want to provide high quality care. Unfortunately, it's just kind of the way our insurance companies, the way the health system, the way that the federal government looks at healthcare, the way it's set up now, again, the way we get paid and get reimbursed for what we do, it's kind of counterintuitive to this digital health movement and keeping people out of the hospital, in their homes. We are seeing a transformation, however, even pre-COVID. So this talk of moving from volume to value, what that truly means is, you know, in a volume-based reimbursement, a fee-for-service, you get paid by how many patients you can see. In a value-based reimbursement, it's all about how do you provide high-quality care for large populations of patients, and how do you keep them healthy out in the communities, and it, more of a kind of preventative lens on it. So that reimbursement transformation has already started with the ACA, and you know that train's already on this track. I think this pandemic is just going to kind of push that movement forward much faster.
And it probably is going to accelerate if patients call for it. I mean, if there is a loud movement of American healthcare consumers who say, you know what, this works better than I thought, I want it this way. Do you think people are going to advocate for this change, Dr. Hasselberg?
I think so, 100%. I mean, we're in an unprecedented time now. I mean, folks are just living their lives different. You know, everyone or the majority of folks are working remotely. They're working from home. The way we hold meetings, the way we socialize with our friends is much different during this pandemic. So folks are used to this technology now. They're more comfortable with it. You know, a lot of folks have had the opportunity during this pandemic pandemic to try digital health and video consultations. And I think folks are seeing, hey, you know, this works, and this is convenient, and I like this. And I think that folks are going to demand a change.
I think that will come if people can. I think that there is probably at least a little bit of a hang up that people might think, well, I've got to see the doctor. There's this idea of seeing a doctor. If you can convince people that you can actually see the doctor with maybe even more time or more efficiently from home, that may convince them, because I think a big question a lot of patients have is, how much time do I actually get face-to-face? My mother, who's had so many different problems in recent years, is always frustrated. She feels the pressure of feeling like, when I get my 5 minutes, I better be ready with my list of questions, because if he's out the door and I don't know something, I don't know when the next chance I get is. Is there going to be, I think, enough evidence for people that you actually will get even the same or more time?
Yeah, you know, and let me preface this. There are still going to be situations that patients do still need to see providers, clinicians face to face. That is never going away. There's no way we can provide all healthcare through a digital mechanism. What we're seeing for a lot of things that we did not think that maybe we could do this successfully via digital mechanism, like telehealth, that's not the case. That this actually works. And now our providers, actually, without the overhead and some of the clunkiness of the previous clinical workflow, actually have a little bit more time to spend with their patients, and really develop a different type of therapeutic rapport. And that's, at least in our Department of Psychiatry, that is what I'm hearing with my colleagues who pre-COVID were not doing telepsychiatry and now have shifted during this COVID crisis, that they themselves are surprised of how easy it is to still establish that rapport. And we've also heard from clients or patients on the other end that they feel more comfortable telling our clinicians things that they may have not felt comfortable telling the clinician face to face. And is it because they feel more relaxed at home and in their own environment? Possibly, but we're seeing that evidence. I think you're going to see a lot of research that's going to come out of this and publications that will back that evidence up. I think we're going to see a hybrid digital health, and then the face-to-face appointments are going to be really limited to, you know, that high level of care that you just can't do virtually.
Surgery, et cetera.
Correct.
Laura Jolly, do you see it that way? I'm not here. In fact, I think we've lost Laura. Vicki, let me bring in Vicki Spur, who's a longtime volunteer for NAMI Rochester. And I think people, again, pressing the point that if they feel like the quality will be there, then I think what Dr. Hasselberg is saying, people will be more open to across disciplines for different needs. When it comes to mental health, any concerns that the quality of appointments would be lesser if they are not in person?
You know, in thinking of telepsychiatry, I remember attending a NAMI conference probably about 6 years ago, and that was the very first that I saw that. And especially, I'm a retired teacher, and I taught in a rural district where access to mental health services is very limited. It being on the west side and trying to find child psychiatrists that would be able to meet with students and their families. Even, you know, our experience as far as trying to find a service provider. So I think in some ways, especially in our regions, when we have family members that are coming, often their loved ones aren't able to get, you know, services just because of the physical location where they are. So I think that would give, you know, the opportunity to have access, to have some face-to-face time. And I have heard some concerns just over, it is always great to be able to, you know, physically see the person, you know, and have that space time. I also participate through a support group with a therapist, and we did that, you know, face-to-face, but we have been doing it via Zoom. And she expressed that she wished she could have physical eyes on all of us, but, you know, this was at least an interim way to provide that level of support and consistency that we're used to receiving. So I feel that on the one hand, it's offering accessibility and some connectivity for some family members who haven't been able, you know, because that's a frequent complaint we hear, as we're not able to make an appointment, we're not able to be seen for 2 months. And especially if you have a family member in crisis, you know, immediacy, you're looking to make that connection, because we're looking at safety. And especially right now during this COVID, we've had family members who have their loved ones are symptomatic and they're out on the streets. They're not practicing social distancing, and they don't even know physically, you know, where they are because they are symptomatic, and being able to at least have some kind of access, if they can even locate and find that, I think that it has its advantages.
Yeah, yeah. Laura, do you see a change in the future of medicine permanently in any way across disciplines post-pandemic?
I think that we have a lot of opportunity to look at how we could implement these televideo and telehealth services into our service line. I really feel like there is a lot of value still with having a patient face-to-face in a therapy session, in group sessions. I really feel like from a mental health standpoint, getting that person to the clinic still holds a lot of value in regards to them not isolating in their home, getting out, being able to practice socialization skills that we really encourage in both mental health and chemical dependency services. So I think there is value to both. I think in regards to access to mental health and addiction medication treatment, I think we could certainly find some value with regards to improving access to those services, but I really truly feel there is still value in a face-to-face visit and having a patient physically in the office.
All right, so listeners, if you want to share your thoughts on any of these issues, let's go ahead and we'll take your phone calls and emails after our only break of the hour. You just heard Laura Jolly, who's an outpatient behavioral health manager at Clifton Springs Hospital and Clinic. We've got Dr. Michael Hasselberg, Chief of Technology and Innovation in the URMC Department of Psychiatry. And we also have Vicki Spurr from NAMI Rochester, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. She's a family program volunteer coordinator. Let's get that break and your thoughts on this fascinating subject on the future of medicine next. I'm Evan Dawson, Monday on The Next Connections. We've been talking to progressives throughout the presidential primaries about what they want to see on the political left in this country. But what about the political right? Conservatives know that it's going to be Donald Trump on the ballot for Republicans in November. We're going to talk to conservatives about their thoughts on the president, about his handling of the pandemic, and about the direction they want to see the country go on Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let me get Peter in Rochester first on the phone. Go ahead, Peter.
Hi, Evan. Thank you so much. I think this is a wonderful conversation that you're having, and it's very insightful. So I just want to first thank you for that.
Sure.
I have a kind of a two-part question concerning telehealth and mental health. One is, I'm curious to know what your panel has to say about providing their patients with sort of that therapeutic alliance, and are they able to capture that, all those nonverbals and all of those things that might, you know, reduce providing accurate empathy and rapport, which is so essential for health. That's one of them. And the other part is for high-risk patients who might be at risk of harming themselves or doing something dangerous, what policies are in place if they need to do like a mental health arrest or get them into a higher level of care?
Two good questions. Dr. Hasselberg, I'll let you start. Go ahead.
Sure. Great questions. So in regards to the therapeutic alliance, I'll tell you a little bit about my own personal experience. I've been a clinician for 15 plus years. And again, the majority of my career is seeing patients face to face. Over the last 4 years, I have only seen patients exclusively via tele, psychiatry and telemedicine. And when I first made the shift, I was very pessimistic that I would not be able to develop that therapeutic alliance with my patients, and was pleasantly surprised. Like, as I had mentioned earlier, I had even heard from my own patients that they felt more comfortable telling me things that they otherwise would not have told me if they had come to see me in the office. And some of these were patients that I had been previously had seen face to face. And in regards to the identifying of nonverbals, you know, with the video quality and technology we have today, you know, I can fairly, in terms of the visual, I can see what I would see in a face-to-face in most cases. The things I may be missing, some of those other senses, you know, maybe if I had a patient in person that had used alcohol early in the day and they came in to see me and I could smell the alcohol, of course, I can't pick up that on a telehealth appointment. In regards to the high-risk patients, you know, we have very kind of strict emergency protocols. So when we do a telemedicine or telepsychiatry visit with a patient, there's of course always a consent that we're getting from the patient before. There's a, you know, we have contact information. You know, what's your best phone number to reach you? Who are the contacts you would want us to reach out to if there was an emergency, like a patient verbalizing that they're maybe suicidal? And we would use kind of the same protocols in regards to mental hygiene arrests if we were, you know, seeing a patient face-to-face. So if we felt that there was a high risk, we would go kind of through the same protocols. But we're a little bit more cognizant of laying out what those emergency procedures are before we engage in that session.
Okay. Laura Jolly, you want to add to that?
Sure. I agree. I think, you know, first and foremost, those of us who have been in the field a long time and learned about a therapeutic alliance learn that it's very much nonverbal, very much, you know, picking up on all the nonverbals of the patients actually sitting in front of you. Here we are in later times and more technologically advanced times that I think it's a shift in the way that the therapist is also thinking about how we're picking up on those nonverbals. Similar to what was just mentioned, I think it's a changing our own comfort around how we can still pick up on those and assess for those while the patient is, you know, communicating with us televideo. Again, as I mentioned before, I think there's still value with bringing the patient in face-to-face. I think depending on the patient and their comfort level, some of our patients, at least here, still really enjoy that connection, you know, especially patients that have a high level of paranoia. Those are the patients we're seeing really struggle with the televideo because it's not comfortable for them. So we still continue to see those patients face-to-face. In terms of the high-risk patients, if we have significant concerns, we're still bringing the patient into the clinic. We have televideo equipment right here in all of our outpatient offices, so they are actually able to come in and sit at a computer and then Skype to a therapist in a different office. But they, being that they're physically here, if an intervention needed to be done with that high-risk patient, we're able to intervene quickly on that as well.
Okay. Vicki Spur, anything you want to add there?
Well, I think I just want to add, you know, through our virtual support group, we've had family members who have a loved one that are out in the community and are looking to do a mental health arrest, but have met some resistance from the police because if the physical, you know, component and, you know, practicing the guidelines for COVID. So I think I want to pose a question to the doctor. Have you run across that, and what is the protocol that would be used within this area? This was out of state, but I think that's always, you know, a concern for a family member. If we need to do a mental health arrest, will the police be able to respond if, mental, you know, or if the mobile crisis team isn't able to, and if it becomes that situation?
That's a great question. So I have not had the situation yet where we've not had the ability to respond. Our mobile crisis team at the university is up on video consultations themselves. Even our psychiatric emergency department is moving towards doing some outreach via video consultations, and I know that the Office of Mental Health also has a pilot pre-pandemic of working with police agencies of doing evaluations with police agencies and EMS on the front lines using video technology. So I have not yet personally run into a situation that we weren't able to secure the safety resources we would need for a patient in significant crisis.
Okay. So before we move to more of our listener feedback, I want to hit an important point that, you know, our listeners may be thinking about. If we're really moving to a world where there's a lot more telemedicine, even post-pandemic, we've seen some stories that I have to say some of them are just weird, where people are sort of bombing, you know, sort of Zoom bombing. Zoom is where a lot happens. Not everything is on Zoom, of course, but there have been a lot of stories about sort of unsecure connections and people kind of hacking into Zoom, and sometimes to do it just to kind of to troll. But there's also a concern about privacy and about acquisition of information. So, Dr. Hasselberg, can patients be confident that if we do a lot more telemedicine, that these video calls and different kind of conferences are going to be secure?
Yes, I think so. I think right now during the COVID pandemic, you know, the Office of Civil Rights and the Department of Health and Human Services really kind of laxed on penalties for HIPAA noncompliance in regards to privacy. And this was a real, this decision was made so we could, you know, serve as many patients as we can via these technologies. And, you know, what we're seeing during this pandemic is, you know, certain potentially unsecured video conferencing platforms are being used by providers, which increase the potential risks for, you know, Zoom bombing and kind of hacking into the video conference. I can speak to the University of Rochester. We have, you know, a security team that, you know, looks at our video conferencing software, make sure it's encrypted, make sure that we've done all the security protocols, and this was even pre- this relaxation on HIPAA that announced by the federal government, to make sure that our teleappointments are secure. And even with this relaxation from the Department of Health and Human Services and Office of Civil Rights that you could use non-secure video conferencing platforms, even that may be more convenient for the patient, we elected as a system to not allow our providers to use those video conferencing platforms. So, you know, what I would say to the consumer, to the patient, you know, we want to protect your privacy as much as you want your privacy protected. So to do your homework on, you know, who's the organization that you're receiving this teleconsultation from, or who's the provider on the other end, and do your homework on kind of understanding who that person is, because I suspect, you know, they are just as concerned about this as the consumer is.
Alex writes to the program to say, my wife suffered a leg bruise injury. She had an appointment with a physician assistant via the MyChart phone app, and it was great. No trip to the hospital or office sitting in a waiting room. We got a beep from the PA when the appointment started. We were able to see the PA, and the PA could see the injury on the phone camera. It was great. Makes sense to keep this even after the pandemic. And I have an upcoming appointment in May, and I look forward to it. And he goes on to say that, you know, remember a generation ago, doctors did house calls, and those went away, and this is the new form of a house call. Dr. Hasselberg, how do you like that analogy?
I love it. You know, it's the, as I said, this kind of fundamental transformation. Instead of, you know, requiring the patient to come to us, we're flipping it, and the provider is coming to you. And that's, in my opinion, that's the way it should be.
Well, Jack in Geneva is concerned about people who have to get to the doctor. Go ahead, Jack.
Well, Evan, apparently I missed the first part of this very interesting program. But frequently when I go in to see a physician for whatever reason, and particularly the primary care, and I have a couple specialists I have to see, the first thing they want to do is weigh you. then they want to take your blood pressure, and then they want to take your temperature and talk to you about, you know, how you've been since the last visit and so forth. I mean, this is a checkup situation, but how do you do that telehousing? I mean, I'm all in favor of this. This would be great because it takes me 30, 35 miles to go to see one of my physicians. So anyway, I'll take my answer off the phone.
Yeah, thank you, Jack. I'll let Dr. Hasselberg start because he's the most sanguine about this this future. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, the great question, Jack. You know, a lot of the technology is moving so quick. What a lot of people don't know is our smartphones can do so much. You know, with just our phone, you know, we can potentially get a patient's heart rate. You know, with our phone, we could potentially get a patient's EKG done. You know, with our phone, where they're testing potential applications, Apple is doing it, where you could get a read of oxygen saturation in red blood cells, so a pulse ox, using the camera on the front of the phone. So technology is really moving quick. So just normal technology people have in their homes can potentially help fill those gaps of getting those vital signs when you arrive. And a lot of patients, you know, have scales in their homes. So can you imagine a world where, you know, the consumer's in their home, they jump on the scale in the morning, they provide that result to their provider, and, you know, their smartphone is able to gather multiple other vital signs that they can provide back to their provider and don't actually have to come in to get that done. It's moving that direction. This technology is moving very quickly, and it's quite accurate.
But just to be clear for Jack, in case he's confused, you're not saying all in-person visits go away.
No, definitely not. You know, there are some things that my smartphone cannot do, and yeah, absolutely, there, you know, are cases. There are different types of diseases and disorders that, you know, we really need that patient to come in and see us in person. Absolutely, you know what I'm, you know, I think the example of the bruise and the PA getting to, you know, see the bruise via the camera, making a diagnosis, making a recommendation, and keeping that patient home from not having to come drive, you know, however distance to the medical centers, you know, find parking, you know, sit in a waiting room with other patients who may be sick and have, you know, contagious symptoms, to then, you know, see the provider if the provider's on time, and then, you know, have to drive back home. That's cumbersome, right? And now, you know, this example of this was quick, this is easy, I opened up my chart, I got the diagnosis, I got what I needed, and I didn't have to leave my house. I mean, that's a prime example.
So, Laura, are you a little less optimistic that all of that can be done, or do you think that is probably the direction?
I think it's going to be a lot based on patient comfort level. Again, I think some of the patients just aren't comfortable with the technology, don't want to become comfortable with technology, and just want to still come in and do those face-to-face visits. But I think as we progress through what this might mean for the mental health field, I think it's really important to continue to have those options available and figure out a way to make them work within our clinics so we can provide that as an option for the patients seeking services.
All right. Scott writes to say, talk about bad timing. I was diagnosed with cancer on March 1st. Surgery is the best treatment option, and the sooner the better. In a non-pandemic world, it would have already been done. I've been sitting on pins and needles, and I was grateful and relieved that I got the call this week that the green light was given for my surgery. I hate the term elective. Without the surgery, the cancer will spread, and I'd be in even more serious trouble. Scott, May 14th, he says, good luck. We're thinking of you. And I think we're going to see more patients, not just cancer surgery, but we're going to see more, according to Dr. Michael Mendoza, get scheduled sooner than later. We might get back to different kinds of screenings and that kind of a thing sooner than later. But we're also hearing this hour that there's more options than we probably previously realized to do things in a different way. Vicki Spur, before we lose you for the hour here, I know NAMI's doing a lot. What do you want to make sure that the community knows about, you know, different support during this pandemic? Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. So on Mondays and Wednesdays at 1 o'clock, if you go to namirock.org, sign up, or you can send an email to info@namirock.org, and we're offering Mindfulness Mondays, Wellness Wednesdays, and so we're looking at, I heard Laura talking about some of those exercises, mindfulness, ways to stay focused, and Wellness Wednesdays. We know part of staying well is eating well, sleeping well, and Christina Mosgraver leads us through those activities on the fourth Monday and the second Tuesday at 6:30. We offer connections, and that's for peers. And then on Fridays, we're offering Family Fridays at 1 o'clock. And for those family members who live in the Genesee, Orleans, Wyoming region, we are offering that at 10 o'clock. And then for college students, that is on Thursday, and that's at 6:30. And again, you can access all of that information at namirock.org. And our executive director, Heather Newton, has done a wonderful job of doing a revolution roundup that can also be accessed to let you know about other services that are out there and available through NAMI.
Laura Jolly, just about 20 seconds. Do you feel like we're adapting as well as we need to during this pandemic?
I do. I think the system, I know at least Rochester Regional Health has really done a lot to pivot and make sure that our patients are getting the care that they need during this difficult time.
You know, we're grateful for that. Dr. Hasselberg, are we going to take some lessons forward from this?
I think so. I think we're going to have a different healthcare system coming out of this, and you know, I think our community is really coming together, pulling together, and I think we may be a gold standard for what the future of healthcare may look like.
I want to say thank you to all of our panel today. Dr. Hasselberg, Chief of Technology and Innovation in the URMC Department of Psychiatry. Fascinating stuff. Michael, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
Laura Jolly, an outpatient behavioral health manager at Clifton Springs Hospital and Clinic. Thank you so much, Laura.
Thanks for having me on.
And Vicki Spurr from NAMI Rochester, doing so much for this community as always. Thank you so much, Vicki.
And thank you so much for having me on. Everyone have a safe weekend.
You got it. Thanks, everyone. And to all the listeners, no matter where you are, we hope that it is a peaceful, calm, and love-filled weekend for you. And we're going to be back with you on Monday with the whole team here. Emma Ray Stein, the intern. Megan Mack is the producer. Rob Braden is the engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Much love. We'll talk to you Monday.